Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today we talk about suicide prevention, which is not the easiest subject in the world to talk about, and that is exactly the point of this year's World Mental Health Day Forum and Information Fair hosted by Mayor Cam Guthrie at City Hall. This was the 20th year for the event, which was started in 2000 by Mayor Joe Young. Each year, the city's various mental health agencies gather to share information and invite dialogue, a conversation that has surely gotten much easier over the last several years in regards to mental health on the whole, but there's still a lot of room to grow on specific topics on the subject. Marking World Mental Health Day is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Suicide is the ninth leading cause of death in Canada, according to the Public Health Agency. It sits between influenza and pneumonia and kidney disease. Over 4,000 people take their own life every year. That's an average of 10 per day, and 90% of those people are living with a mental health issue or illness. For one suicide death, there are 5 people hospitalized with a self-inflicted injury. There are 25 to 30 attempts, and 7 to 10 people left behind are affected by the loss of suicide. Is it just me, or does this seem like a huge problem that we never really talk about? Of course, that's the point of making it the topic of this year's World Mental Health Day event at City Hall. Suicide is vastly misunderstood in terms of the reasons and recriminations. Yes, 9 out of 10 people who take their own lives have a mental or addictive disorder, and yes, 6 out of 10 suffer from some form of depression. But according to a report by Health Canada, quote, no single determinant, including mental illness, is enough on its own to cause a suicide. Rather, suicide typically results from the interaction of many factors, for example, mental illness, marital breakdown, financial hardship, deteriorating physical health, a major loss, or a lack of social support. This is one of the many points that came up with the 3 speakers that took part in the forum last Thursday, and on this edition of the podcast, we'll hear from each of them as they tell their story. First, there's Scott Grant, who is a clinical social worker who facilitates suicide intervention groups. Scott uses his lived experience with mental health diagnosis to help provide support and hope to others. Then you'll hear from Myrna Hutchinson, who is the founder of Get in Touch for Hutch, a youth mental health awareness and advocacy group. Myrna began the organization after she lost her son, Stephen, to suicide in 2013. And finally, there's Cecilia Marie Roberts, who has trained thousands of community members to be alert to suicide and how to have difficult conversations with loved ones in distress. She is a leading suicide prevention framework advocate for the Canadian Mental Health Association of Waterloo, Wellington. Before going to the audio, it seems prudent to post a trigger warning. These stories are quite emotional and quite raw, and it's not unlikely to think that this could make for some uncomfortable listening for some of you. If you need to, feel free to hit stop on the podcast. And if you feel like you need more help than that, there's information in the show notes of this episode that you can use. So let's go back to City Hall on Thursday for World Mental Health Day.
I've been asked to speak today from a platform of my lived experience with a mental health diagnosis. I choose to do these talks because we tend to have a lot of comfort talking about our health from the neck down. That's a very easier topic for a lot of folks. When it comes to talking about health from the neck up, stigma gets in the way. We isolate, we shutter, we close doors. And I've noticed from my lived experience as a man to open up and talk about a lived experience with a mental health diagnosis, that can be a bit more tricky for some. So that's why I take these opportunities to kind of talk about my lived experience as well. So for the past 4.5 years, I've been a social worker on the Skills for Safer Living team at the Canadian Mental Health Association. That Skills for Safer Living is a suicide prevention, so we work to stop the occurrence and incidence of suicide. It is an intervention group, so we work to support people in the throes of suicide, and it is a postvention group, and we work with folks who have already attempted suicide to make safer choices and live safer. As a facilitator of the program, I'm asked to kind of balance 2 things at the same time. I like to think two schools of thought. The first school of thought is my professional training as a social worker, so I bring in the research, I bring in the theory, all that stuff. The second piece that I'm asked to bring in is the ups and downs, the trials and tribulations of my lived experience and my ongoing mental health recovery. So I bring the two together and they kind of wrap together. to bring a kind of comprehensive approach. And I found that sharing my lived experience is a wonderful way to connect with people and break down those barriers. So I'm going to take you through a journey, a brief journey, through my lived experience, the onset of a diagnosis. I've put together five sort of elements, tips, concepts that I've kind of picked up along the way that I use to support myself, and we'll kind of wrap up from there. In 2008, I was a budding social worker at Laurentian University. I had long debates in the library around the political economy of homelessness, debated, you know, people like Noam Chomsky and Michael Foucault, and I had just read Carl Rogers. I was on my way. I was president of the Student Association. I was a research assistant, a teaching assistant, and I was working on some research with a professor. Now, I'm not listing off my resume for everybody. What I wanted to do is kind of set the stage in the sense that if you had looked at me from the outside, you probably wouldn't know I had a lot of depression and anxiety going on. So we can't always see mental health from the exterior. With that depression and anxiety, I stuffed and I stuffed and I stuffed and I stuffed. I ignored because as a man, I didn't want to be vulnerable. And as a social worker at the time, counseling was for something I did to others. I wasn't a client. I was going to be a therapist. In January of 2008, my world got pretty scary. It got pretty dark. I was pretty isolated. Paranoid. Going to class was really, really challenging. And for the first time, I entertained thoughts of ending my life. I made a lonely walk to the hospital to seek out support. As a social worker, I thought, well, having thoughts of ending my life probably isn't a good thing, and I should probably get some support. So what followed that initial hospital visit were many other visits with mental health professionals. I saw a psychiatrist for the first time. I was assigned my own psychiatric nurse. I felt, you know, pretty lucky to have kind of a sidekick and somebody there. I was prescribed some medication, and at the time, the medication was pretty strong. I felt very sleepy, very drowsy, and it was even harder to kind of go on and do the things that I had enjoyed. Despite that, I finished my undergrad degree, applied to grad school, got into grad school, finished grad school while doing readings in the emergency department and that kind of thing. So I got through it, and mental health became a piece of recovery for me. I had invested interest in my work. So I thought, you know, after I received the diagnosis, you know, when the psychiatrist gave me my diagnosis, the room shrunk. It was pretty scary. And I thought, okay, I've lost just about everything. I don't think I can be a social worker. I can't do this anymore. And there was a real sense of loss. And what I've realized in retrospect, looking back 10, 11 years later, that I gained a lot of things. And I wanted to share some principles that I used to kind of guide myself through the day. And hopefully I can share them with you. Now, these aren't clinical. These are from my lived experience. And this is kind of what peer support looks like. Everybody in this room has mental health, right? Like we have physical health. We have a responsibility to maintain that health. So mental health isn't something that happens to others. It's not something for the person, you know, we see who's talking to themselves or accessing emergency support services. We all have mental health as we do physical health. What is good for our bodies is usually good for our heads. So sleep, exercise, diet, nutrition is good for the body, it's good for the head. Tip two, sometimes we just have to do it. I am very good at planning, scheming, thinking. And when I'm in the throes of my own stuff, it can be very easy for me to get lost in the thoughts. And I've learned after trial and error that sometimes I just have to do it. You know, don't think about it, do it. So in this, I play a little game with myself. I'll say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go, do it. And that's for things like getting out of bed, going to work, taking care of myself, doing things to support my wife around the house, We just have to do it. We have to act. And we can't always plan it out and think. And in skills, we talk about the word and. So it took me a while to realize this, that I can be really depressed and really anxious and really scared, and I can go to work, and I can support my wife, and I can still take care of myself. So when I learned the word and, it was really helpful to me. It was like a hinge, almost. Number three is finding a network. In the counseling world, we talk about the most important therapeutic piece is having a strong connection with the person you're working with. Finding somebody you feel safe and comfortable with to connect with. I went through 9 different therapists. I didn't fire them. I just realized it wasn't a fit for me. And until I landed on somebody that understood me and got me, that I felt safe with, that's when my recovery started to kind of get into high gear. I always akin it to when I'm working with folks that sometimes finding a therapist is like buying a pair of jeans. They could be really nice jeans, well-intentioned jeans, great-fitting jeans, but they don't fit, right? They're not a fit for you. And so finding that connection, and it doesn't have to necessarily be a professional connection. The first person I connected with was a professor and just happened to be an ex-social worker, so I got double lucky. But finding somebody that you feel safe with is kind of the first step. Try new things, even if you think it's a ridiculous idea. My psychiatric nurse asked me if I wanted to try meditation. And I was so focused on, give me the CBT, give me the pills, and I'll be fine. I've meditated now for 8-9 years. An example, we had an all-staff meeting at CMHA yesterday. And there were these drums, these sticks that we had to drum with. And it was going to be an exercise program. And I looked at those sticks, like, I don't want to do this. And I thought of this, you know, sometimes you just need to kind of get outside your comfort zone and do something new. And it was really fun. And it kind of broke the tension. So in doing this, I've discovered that I like photography. I like cooking. I love canoeing. And I carry lavender with me wherever I go as a soothing technique. And the last one, tuning in and listening to our bodies. Our bodies know us really well. And when I stuffed and ignored, I imploded. And our feelings are, this is such a therapist thing to say, our feelings have meaning and purpose. And that is, our feelings are trying to communicate to us. And so taking time to stop and click in and understand what it is that our bodies are trying to say to us. We want to be proactive, right? Yeah. So I never thought I would say this, but my mental health diagnosis and crisis has been, it's been a blessing in disguise. I look back now, and I'm glad it happened, because I think it's made me a better person and a better therapist. And there are some things in my world that I probably wouldn't have never discovered had I not had my brush with the mental illness. And I wanted to leave that with you, that there is hope. So thank you.
I would like to begin today's presentation by extending a very warm thank you to Angela and the Mayor's Event Planning Committee for the invitation to be here and share a part of my story today. What I will share with you acknowledges the impact that suicide has had on our family, our friends, and our community. As earlier mentioned, my name is Myrna Hutchison. I work full-time in a corporate office not too far from here and have done that for the last 31 years. The most important job title, though, that I will ever hold is mom. Life for my family was considered fairly normal until everything changed on a bright and sunny wintry day in February 2013. This is not your fault. Those were some of the very last words that we received in writing from our son, Stephen, who died by suicide on February 10, 2013. A parent is not supposed to bury their child. A brother is not supposed to bury his only brother, and 18-year-olds are not supposed to bury their friends. This tragic task was given to us when we were notified that our oldest son, Stephen, had taken his life while in his dorm room at university. For us, there was an instant and associated guilt that came with losing our son to suicide. How did something so tragic happen when at no point did this heartbreaking outcome ever once enter onto our radar as a possibility of ever occurring? Where did we, as parents, go wrong? Sadly, no one, not Stephen's friends, nor his family, teammates, or classmates, would have expected that this wonderfully amazing guy, who seemed to have the world and all of its incredible opportunities at his fingertips, would ever do something like this. In an instant, our entire world was turned upside down and shattered into a million different and tiny little pieces. After losing Stephen, our normal family structure, one that we had always known and become accustomed to for the past 18 years, had totally changed. My youngest son had become an only child, and many others, similar to us, were left with a huge hole in our hearts and our lives, because whatever it was that Stephen was battling ended up making him feel like there was no other choice in life but to end his own. I often try to think of what we could have done differently, how we could have helped, or what we could have done or said to Stephen if he'd only reached out to tell us, or if we had recognized that he was struggling. Stephen was an exceptional student and natural-born athlete, and often put a lot of pressure on himself to excel or perform. In hindsight, I wish I had taken the opportunity to look into his beautiful blue eyes and let him know that just by being himself, he was absolutely 100% enough. He had so much more to offer the world without always feeling the need to be the high-achieving scholar or athlete. We and so many others loved him for just exactly who he was. In hindsight, I would have wanted Stephen to know that no one in this world, not anyone, has a perfect life, and that there are times when we all have to work through a struggle or a difficult, and for some, a very dark time in our lives. I also would have wanted Stephen to know that there is absolutely no problem in this world that is too big for us not to be able to solve together. Although I believe that we had the kind of relationship where our kids would tell us anything and everything, I would have told Stephen that even if he didn't feel comfortable reaching out to his parents or those closest to him to tell them about what he was going through, that there were others that he could have talked to, and some of those incredible services are here with us today. After telling Stephen that, I would have confirmed the fact that we would always be there for him so that he knew he was never alone on this journey. I would also have wanted Stephen to know that no matter how unloved or hopeless he felt, that he needed to know that there were so many people who loved him and would be willing to help with whatever issue it was that he needed support for. And then I would have asked all of those people to show Stephen all the love that they had for him so that he knew for sure. All of this is just a simple reiteration of all the things that we just assumed that Stephen knew. Stephen wasn't one who expressed his emotions, didn't talk about the things that were bothering him, and didn't outwardly appear that he was in a place to take his life, not even on the day that we lost him to suicide. There are many documented telltale signs that may indicate that someone is at risk for suicide, but to us, Stephen didn't outwardly or noticeably display any one of them. He didn't withdraw from his friends, didn't stop going to social events, or start having issues with his grades. He didn't stop eating, start sleeping more, or give away any of his prized possessions. Stephen had not been formally diagnosed with a mental illness and led what would be considered a regular teenager's life. He could often be found spending time with his friends, listening to country music, or playing video games. He loved his sports, hockey and lacrosse most specifically, was a respected member of the many teams that he played for, and always worked hard and did well in school. From our learnings along this grief journey, we know that there are many who struggle, who hide all of those emotions behind a mask. And for us, that mask was the bright and beautiful smile that our son always seemed to share so willingly with others. Stephen was also well known for being one of the first who would step up to assist others as they were working through their own problems, a great characteristic of a good friend and great teammate. However, I will forever wish that he would have only realized that he too deserved that same exact support that he so freely and lovingly gave to others. As much as I'm here to share our story about how life has changed for us after losing our son to suicide, today and every single day since, I'm haunted with the thoughts of the vast amount of energy that it must have taken Stephen to get through all of those difficult days, when no one had any idea just exactly how intense his internal struggles were, how much additional weight he was carrying on his shoulders as the walls of stigma continued to build up around him, or just totally how alone he must have felt, even in a room filled with lots of friends or family, all of whom loved him more than anyone can imagine. The consideration of all of those thoughts, feelings, and emotions that consumed Stephen are none that neither you nor I will ever get a true understanding for, unless we walk down a similar path to the one that he did. Bless you. Today I come to encourage us all to be okay with not being okay, and to know that it is okay to start talking about it. We need to bring the silence out of the shadows. We need to show when we are angry, cry when we are sad, and smile and laugh when there is a reason to do so. We need to stop caring about what others think if we're having a bad day, or if those bad days turn into way more than one. We are all living human beings with beating hearts. And we need to start giving each other the permission so that we all know it's okay not to be okay every single day. Often when we see advice about how we help someone who is struggling with a mental health concern, the messages most often say, tell them to reach out for support. Our life's tragedy has taught us that it's not right to expect that those who are in a place of darkness to reach out, because to be honest with you, sometimes they barely have enough energy to get out of bed that day, let alone pick up the phone and try to explain why they think they're feeling the way that they are. Our job as kind and caring community citizens is to start reaching in to those who don't seem like themselves any longer, to those who may be missing a lot of work or who are no longer coming out to be part of our social circle. Take notice and take the first step to help them face whatever it is that they are struggling with. You do not need to have all of the answers. Just make that connection. A new term we've learned is to hold space and help them get the help that they need. Because we didn't know that Stephen was going through a difficult time, that also means that we didn't get the chance to help him. This also weighed heavily on our family and friends. Not long after Stephen passed, a group of his friends came over to deliver a very special gift to our family. Everyone in the room that day was feeling an extremely deep level of grief from this tragedy and knew that they didn't want another group of friends or family members to have to go through what it was that we were experiencing. It was from conversations that happened on that exact day that the concept of Get in Touch for Hutch, our youth mental health advocacy group, was born. Get in Touch for Hutch was created in an effort to start a conversation amongst youth to help normalize the conversation around mental health. Our mandate is to join forces with schools, sporting organizations, and our community as a whole to share messages of hope, providing youth with awareness information, tools, and resources that they need to work through those difficult days, and to get them the help that they need in the way that they need it at the exact time that they do. Our hope is that the more we talk about it, the easier it will be to make it part of our everyday conversation. Some of you may be aware of our latest project, the Buddy Bench. The Buddy Bench is a bright red bench that is placed on the school playground to encourage conversation, kindness, inclusion, and empathy in and around the school environment. To date, we have rolled out more than 44 benches to schools within the Upper Grand and Wellington Catholic School Board and have received quite positive feedback on that project. We are absolutely in awe about the countless number of amazing individuals that we have met along the way through our Buddy Bench initiative and all of the other youth mental health advocacy work that we've been involved in. I only wish that those who are struggling had a chance to realize just how many people there are out there who care so deeply and would do anything they can to help with whatever it is that they are dealing with. I do remember that it wasn't all that long ago that we weren't comfortable saying the word cancer, or that people didn't have a clear level of understanding of the impacts of drinking and driving either. Today, we continue to have difficulty saying the word suicide. And often, many people still feel uneasy when someone talks about their mental health issue. Time and awareness have changed our view on both cancer and drinking and driving. Now it is our responsibility to change what the topics of mental health and suicide awareness look like. We are all going to make this change happen together. One person cannot do it alone, and sadly, it's going to take a bit of time. But I want you all to know, by having those conversations and by being supportive of others who may be struggling, that little by little, we will remove brick by brick of that invisible, yet ever so invasive, wall of stigma that creates such a roadblock for people to be able to reach out for the help that they need at the exact time that they need it. Again, we are so very grateful for the opportunity to present here today as we come together to discuss such an important topic on World Mental Health Day. To my fellow presenters and those in attendance, thank you for your commitment and ongoing contributions in working towards changing the landscape of mental health. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. When I hugged Myrna, I said, Myrna, I have to stop speaking after you. I'm not really sure what else I can say, honestly. First of all, thank you so much to Mayor Guthrie and the organizing committee for having me here. When I started to think about what I was going to say, of course, preventing suicide, let's talk about it. It really resonates for me as someone who's been working in the field for over 15 years now. The reality is that talking about suicide is a difficult thing. I think as society, we have made great strides in terms of our ability to talk about mental health. You know, we're comfortable, we're more comfortable, as Mayor Guthrie spoke about in the opening remarks, with depression, with anxiety. But suicide is still something that has a heaviness to it. There's a fear associated with it, and negative stereotypes connected to it that lead to stigma. It's really quite widely misunderstood, to be perfectly honest. And those that are struggling or touched by suicide are struggling to speak about it because it's so painful, and there's so much shame attached to it for many people. So I thought maybe what I could do today was to spend a little time having a conversation about why is it so difficult and how can we get better at it. Because the reality is if we want to address suicide as a community, we have to be able to talk about it. And we have to have it be part of our conversation, consistently and casually enough for those that are struggling with it, that they too can feel comfortable to reach out and talk about it. So let's start by maybe understanding what is suicide. Well, the first thing that you need to know about suicide is that it isn't a mental illness. It is a complex behavior. And, researchers or clinicians would describe it as a complex issue involving multiple factors that interact with each other and are also influenced by the environment in which a person lives. So that's kind of a mouthful. What does that really mean? Suicide is about pain, and where that pain comes from can look different for each and every one of us. Certainly, there's a lot of pain that is associated with struggling with our mental health or with a mental illness, but there's also a lot of pain that is associated with stressful life events, with loss and grief. And loss and grief, I think, can be hidden. I think we associate loss and grief with death or losing a loved one. But loss comes into our lives so much more than that. The loss of a job, the loss of a marriage, the loss of a child as they go off to college and you're missing them. The loss of who you thought you were going to be in the world, maybe. Loss is a big, big theme when we talk about suicide. Also, struggling with financial issues, struggling with family breakdown, substance abuse, all of these things can contribute to pain and problems. And I think, we can all relate to that, right? We all have things in our world that we struggle with. But the thing about suicide is that when those pains start to add up and when they start to overwhelm us and when that sense of it's just too much to carry gets heavier and heavier, and we lose sense that things will likely shift or change, then we've lost hope. And that is the environment in which thoughts of suicide grow. And we can all get there. We can all get there. So I think it's really important for us to understand suicide as something that is a potential for every one of us and is really an output of just being human. I think it helps us to frame a conversation or maybe connect to or have empathy for folks that are struggling. The other thing that makes suicide difficult to talk about is stigma. Now, the stigma that's associated with mental health is particularly dangerous. And the reason why that is, it's one thing to be judged because you have a problem from, you know, you're struggling with an issue, with an illness. But it goes beyond that where mental health is concerned. When we judge, when we look down on, when we attach certain negative stereotypes to people that are struggling with their mental health, it drives that person underground in terms of getting help. And it prevents them from seeking help. And in fact, we know that for every 3 people that struggle with poor mental health or a mental illness, that 2 out of 3 of them will not seek help because of that stigma. So when you place what is really discrimination, and when we talk about it in the context of our mental health, it's so much more dangerous. It's preventing people from reaching out and really getting the help. And we can't even imagine that to be the case if someone that we loved had cancer. You know, that 2 out of 3 people would not seek help for cancer. And so stigma can be a very sort of deadly piece of this conversation. And I think when we, you know, look at the stigma that's associated with suicide, it is shrouded in everything that we know or feel about mental health, but it's also shrouded in the fear around what do we say, how do we have that conversation, and how might we leave space for somebody who actually is thinking about dying? And what does that have to do with me if I'm in their lives? So there's a lot of pieces of stigma that have yet to be really fully kind of unpacked, shall we say, where suicide is concerned. And the more that we have these opportunities to come together and talk about suicide, the more opportunities that we'll have to continue to unpack the stigma. So stigma is another big theme that we have to sort of think about when we're thinking about talking about suicide. Another thing that I hear over and over again from the people who are really the experts in suicide, which are, of course, the people with lived experience, is how important language is. When I came to town in January to develop a framework for suicide for the Wellington area, Wellington-Guelph area, one of the things that I did was I had some focus groups with people with lived experience. And I spoke to people that were bereaved by suicide, you know, like Myrna, and I spoke to people that had attempted suicide. And, you know, if you really want to understand suicide, these are the people that, you know, you can spend some time with, and they really will help, they'll really, you know, help you to understand the depth of emotion and issues that are connected. But one of the things that I heard from them very clearly was how important language is in terms of supporting us to talk about suicide. So one of the ways that we often express suicide is to say that someone committed suicide. And I've never heard anyone say that someone committed cancer or committed heart disease. We say that they die by cancer or they die of heart disease. And suicide is not a sin, nor is it a crime. And so it's really important that we drop and shift, you know, we drop that language, we shift to when we're speaking about suicide, that to say that someone died by suicide or someone attempted suicide. It's a little thing, but it means so much. And I just want to read you something as part of the focus groups that I had. I just want to read you this. This is sort of a line, a bit of the text of, or a bit of the conversation that we had that night. And I feel like the way that this woman spoke about language and how important it was to her is, you know, her words are better than mine. When I hear the phrase committed suicide, I go numb, and the waves of guilt and shame come. I try to hold back the tears, or sometimes the anger, and I try to hide what I'm feeling because it's too hard to talk to people who don't get it. Many people have felt that they have the right to ask me why, as if I could answer that question. And others simply have stopped coming around or calling. I guess my pain is too much of a burden to them. And that's a very, very powerful statement. but it really is about the language that we use to have conversations with people about suicide. And I don't tell you this to make you fearful of those conversations. I tell you this to make you aware and to be open and to check in with people and say, is that okay? Did I say that okay? How can we have this conversation, and how can I make you feel safe in this conversation? I mean, Myrna spoke about holding space, and holding space is really what we need to learn to do, which is to just listen in a non-judgmental way to the pain that is associated with whatever is going on for individuals, whether or not they're feeling suicidal or they're just having a bad day, right? But this open stance can get quickly closed when we use the wrong language. So that's another way that we maybe really need to think about kind of changing up some of the words that we use to encourage more thoughtful and meaningful conversations about suicide. So I'm very passionate about this topic. I could talk for a long time. I know I've only been 15 minutes, so I have to follow my slides. What can we do? The first thing I would really encourage everyone in this room to do, if they haven't already, is to attend a Safe Talk or Assist training. These are trainings that are designed for the general public to help you understand and be alert to the signs that someone's distress might be getting to the point where they're thinking of suicide, and then how to ask that amazing gift of a question that we all need to learn how to ask is, are you thinking about suicide? And then also feel confident to know, after I've had a chance to listen to the pain that's associated with that, where is it and how is it that I connect them to our professional folks who can help that individual understand their suicidal ideation and what they can do to stay safe so that those thoughts don't come in, don't turn into behaviors or actions that can be life-threatening. You can change your language. You can challenge stigma. And as I say again and again, reach out to those struggling. And they do need us to reach out, or as Myrna says, reach in, right? And last but certainly not least is, if you're struggling, be as brave as the first speaker was to reach out. And, you know, certainly here in this area, we're very fortunate to have a front door to all of our services at In Here 24/7, and they're available all the time. I just want to finish up by just giving you a quick overview of the Here for Hope project that I'm involved in. Here for Hope is a renewed and a focused look and at suicide in Wellington and Guelph. Of course, you know, there's lots of work that has been done, not only by professionals, but by community members and individuals in this community for many years, actually, in the fight against or in the discussion about suicide. But the reality is in the last couple of years, there's been a bit of a spike in the number of individuals that we've lost. And so after a large event in Wellington last fall, there was a renewed sense that, you know what, we need to focus on this. We need to gather the people together that are doing this work. We need to work together. We need to work better. And so that is the task that I was given when I came to town last January, to really kind of create a framework of, you know, how can we all, what should we be doing, and how can we work together? So the Here for Hope project is the Guelph Wellington Life Promotion Suicide Prevention Project. It's taking a whole community approach, which means there's a role for everyone. Suicide and the prevention of suicide and the promotion of life is something that we all need to contribute to. And it's the goal of the project to help everyone understand what their role could be and to support them to take that role on. You know, we're just about ready to drop a website, which will have lots of information for people who are interested in what's being done and how they might be able to do more. Getting ready to launch an awareness campaign called Suicide is About Pain that we really hope will help this conversation to continue and to deepen within all of the nooks and crannies of the community. Early stages of developing a media professional training for media professionals. We're also going to host another Here for Hope event, just like the one that we did last November in Wellington. And we're going to continue to do that every year. And that's going to be a way to reconnect with each other, to celebrate what we've been able to accomplish, to look for other things that we still want to do, and to just come together as the community. We're going to focus a bit on workplace wellness and how we can build resources in the county of Wellington and how that might be able to spill to other municipalities and focus on some resources for that. And I'm really excited to say that we're going to be launching a postvention team, which is a specialized team who will be able to respond to and support individuals that have been touched in the aftermath of suicide. We also have signed on to be part of a national demonstration project that is being supported by the Mental Health Commission of Canada, which is called Roots of Hope. That will allow us to brag a little bit about what we're doing here and also to be learn from and grow with eight communities across the country that will all be taking this whole community approach to suicide and will be collectively evaluating it to see this sort of approach in Canada. It's worked in other countries, but what happens when we use this approach in Canada and what might we learn from that we can share with other communities across the country. This initiative is currently being funded by CMHA and the County of Wellington and the OPP, but make no mistake, this initiative is really so much more than that. There are numerous professional and community organizations and individuals that really will and are the Here for Hope project. As the lead, I thank you for inviting me here today. I don't live in this community. I drive in every day, but I'm really very, I'm really getting very attached. And no, my husband will not move us here, but I say that to mean that I'm looking forward to building stronger relationships over the next 3 years, and my door is always open. So thank you so much.
And once again, that was Preventing Suicide. Let's talk about it. The 20th annual World Mental Health Day event hosted by Guelph's mayor. Cecilia Marie Roberts mentioned Here 24/7, which, if you don't know, is the front door to the addictions, mental health, and crisis services provided by 12 agencies from across Waterloo, Wellington. If you feel like you might be in crisis, you can call them and they can direct you to the service you need and how you can navigate the system. Just call 1-844-437-3247 or 1-844-HERE-247. And that is it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus. And to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from our host at Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast, you will also get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Friday. You can get in touch with me by email, adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. Check out Guelph Politico on Facebook at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how at guelphpoliticos.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be an episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.